Let's call a meeting of the Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee to order. And Representative Johnson, did you read the minutes?
Yes, I did.
Okay, Representative Johnson approves the minutes of March 17th. Any corrections, additions to those minutes? Seeing none, the minutes, all in favor of approving the minutes of March 17th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Minutes are approved. First of all, we have House File 551, Representative O'Neill's bill. Welcome to our committee. Your committee.
Yes, our committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to move your bill?
I'll move my bill, House File 551, to be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Jobs.
Very well.
And I'm just waiting for a couple of testifiers to come from Deed and Dolly, but I'm going to start with the bill, and then this has been a great collaborative effort. Representative Isaacson and I have worked on this bill at great length. It's a collaboration between industry experts, employers, hired institutions, and labor to define competency standards. And I'm not sure, do you have these in your packets? I think you might. Okay. So we're going to have Dolly come up in a minute once Jessica Lumen comes and talk about this, the pipeline project. So the result of the pipeline project is that they identified four of the major categories or industries that are in high need, high demand, and high pay: advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, and IT. So out of that, this bill was birthed. And so this bill establishes a dual training program grant, which would be administrated by Deed. Employers can apply for the grant and train their employees in occupations which have been identified by the pipeline project, which is this, which is high growth and high wage. And hopefully Dolly will be here. She's on her way. Okay. So Jessica Luma will be here in just a minute to kind of explain the pipeline project and the results of that work and how that morphed into this bill. Some of the components I want to talk about before we have her come up, we're a little bit different than the Senate version on a couple components. And how this grant would start is that there's a contract has to be started between the employer and the employee. And once they decide their how they would address this and move forward, then that's the employee would apply for both Pell, so both state and federal grants. And once that's satisfied, then the employer would put in a certain proportion. And the percentage of the proportion would be in direct proportion to the size of their company. So if they're a $50 million or more, they would put in 66% of the costs of whatever's left over after Pell and state grants. If they're between 20 and 50 million, they would put in 50%. If they're between 10 and 20 million, they'd put in 33%. And if they're under 10 million, the employer would put in 20%. And let me know if Jessica comes in. Oh, she's here? Okay, so I'm going to move to Jessica Lumen from Dolly, and she can explain the pipeline project.
Okay. Members, we need the first engrossment of the bill that's being printed, and it'll be here pretty soon.
Ah, very good. Well, then I'd like to have my testifier speak just to the pipeline project and how this, how our bill is kind of birthed out of this project.
John warned me, so I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, Representative Neal. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Lumen. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry, and I'm extremely excited to tell you today about the progress that we've made on what we're calling the pipeline project. As most of you know, we started this project last year. A lot of you were very familiar with this project as it was developed, and I think all of you should have a copy of the report, and then also available for the public, there is copies of the executive summary of the project. I just want to first start off by thanking so many people who really contributed to this project. We've been doing it for only about, only since June of last year. And it's thanks to the legislative authors, including Representative Norton, who just walked in on the project, as well as partners at DEED, at MNSCU, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, MNSCU, as well as representatives from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and equally importantly, over 200 industry representatives from the four industries that we're really working on began this project really in August of last year, and we have learned so much from all of the members of our industry councils in terms of what it's really going to take for the agriculture industry, the healthcare industry, the advanced manufacturing industry, and the IHT industry to be able to embrace the concept of apprenticeship or dual training. The pipeline project itself leverages the Department of Labor and Industry's work with registered apprenticeship, which many of you are very familiar with. We currently have about 9,000 registered apprentices in the state of Minnesota, most of whom are in the construction trades, which have a long history of using the registered apprenticeship model in order to develop skilled craft workers. And the way that we conceived of this program and really have started to execute it is that we decided to step back from registered apprenticeship and look at the core components of it, which are employment, related instruction, and on-the-job training. And if we take away those three, just those three components of registered apprenticeship, how can we flip the model on its head and really, instead of a train and then place model, which is currently what's usually used in these industries, how can we instead do a place and then train model? And one of the things that we learned lots of things from the industry representatives, but one of the things that we really learned was that because of workforce needs and because of workforce development needs, there is interest and people are open and industry is open and associations are open to really thinking about this new model and a new way of training workers. So we had three industry council meetings of each of the four industries, again, healthcare, advanced manufacturing, IT, and agriculture. And what we were able to do is we were able to explore the dual training model. We were able to identify at least four occupations in each of those industries that the industry councils believed could really be served by the dual training model, by the place and then train model. We were able to begin to define competencies that are necessary for each of these occupations. So what does it really mean to be a herd manager in the agriculture industry, and how can we make sure that everybody in the industry agrees that those are the core competencies needed for that occupation? And then also we were able to start some dual training programs and discuss how we can support current registered apprenticeship programs in these industries. We do have registered apprenticeship in manufacturing right now. We have about 16 registered apprenticeship programs in manufacturing. We don't currently have any registered apprenticeship programs in IT or agriculture, and we have one really strong and ready to grow registered apprenticeship program in the healthcare industries. So we're looking to leverage what we already have as well as to see if we can expand this model in other occupations. So I just want to quickly go over the recommendations from the report so that you all can see how many of those align with the recommendations and the tasks that the commissioner is asked to continue to work on under Representative O'Neill and Representative Isaacson's bill that we're looking at today. And it really does reflect many of those recommendations from the report. The first recommendation is to complete the occupational competency standards for all of the occupations identified through the pipeline project. Again, when we talk about occupational competencies, that is the skills, knowledge, and ability that's necessary for a worker to go from an entry-level worker to really a master or a specialist or a skilled worker in their occupation. And the tricky part about this is, as you all know, is getting the entire industry to agree. And that's really the work that we're doing right now. All 15 of the occupations that were identified in the pipeline project, and we can certainly share with you what all of those are, all 15 have a preliminary occupational competency standard model developed. The next step is to validate those model and get approval from each of the industries. And that's work that we're continuing to do through June when this project, when the current phase of this project is over, and that this bill helps us continue to do following the end of the first phase of the pipeline project. Recommendation number two is to build industry competency councils for each targeted industry to develop competency standards for the pipeline occupations as well as additional occupations in each of those industries. One of the things we heard over and over from our industry councils was that what about this occupation? What about this is also going to be helpful? What about this one? And so what we agreed to as part of our project is that the first three or four that were identified would be where we would start, and we put our resources there. But we know that there are other occupations in each of these industries that are also conducive to the dual training model. Recommendation number three was to establish dual training committees for at least one pipeline project identified occupation in each target industry. That's the recommendation right now in terms of the pilot of the of this project. We are really excited about helping, at the Department of Labor and Industry, about helping industry build their capacity to do this kind of work. And what that means is that you need to have a committee of industry representatives, representative employers, labor and industry, really able to sit down and say, how are we going to deliver on these competency standards? Recommendation number four is for the Department of Labor and Industry to develop templates and implementation tools for dual training programs for all of the occupations that are identified in the pipeline project. This is one of the things that we heard many times from our industry councils, which is, okay, all right, we agree to the competency standards and we're interested in dual training, but how do we actually do it? What we need how-to, we need step-by-step, we need checklists. We don't want to reinvent this every single time that we want to do a new dual training program. So labor and industry is really committed to providing those tools for employers and their industry representatives who want to start these programs. Recommendation number five, create and execute a plan for dual training outreach, development, and awareness. You'll see this is one of the duties that's assigned to labor and industry in this bill. One of the things, and you I know hear this all the time as well when you're talking to industry, is we need to get more kids, more parents, more people of color, more veterans, more everybody excited about these industries and excited about occupations in these industries. So that's something that we really are focusing on and want to continue to work on. Recommendation number six from the pipeline project was to align dual training delivery systems with other workforce initiatives. Dual training is about employers and industry and labor and government all investing in workforce, like many other workforce development programs that we have in the state. And how do we leverage those? How do we align those and not duplicate those so that we make sure we're using the best, making the best use of all of our resources? Recommendation number seven. Develop research and analysis tools to determine dual training systems' costs and benefits for employers. For many of you know that a lot of the dual training and dual education model is a European-based model that has been used very well in the United States for centuries in many occupations. But one of the things that we've learned from our partners in Germany and in Switzerland, and as well as many of the other folks that we've really learned more about dual education from, is that you need to be able to explain how much it costs and what the cost-benefit analysis is for anyone who's looking to invest in this kind of a program. And so one of the recommendations that came out of the industry councils was you got to do that work. You've got to look and see how much it costs, what the benefits are, what are the long-term retention schedules, all of those kinds of things to make sure that this continues to work for both the workers who are being trained in this model and for the employers who are investing in it. And finally, the recommendation number eight was, and this was an area where we actually spent quite a bit of time in our industry council meetings, was talking about how do we support this and is there financial support that's necessary and to do what? And one of the outcomes of the industry council meetings was that it's difficult for people to start these kinds of programs and then to continue to sustain them and make them viable. And so one of the recommendations coming out of the group was for the legislature to consider providing necessary financial support in order to make dual training programs both viable and sustainable for employers and employees. So, again, we've been working on this since June. We have a lot more work to do. I'm excited about the commitment and, again, so appreciative of how many people have really given so much time, energy, and effort in order to get to where we are today. DLI supports continued expansion of dual training and registered apprenticeship throughout the state. We serve as both a resource and a regulator of registered apprenticeship programs. And we believe that we have made a good start on this important project to help develop Minnesota's skilled workforce in these four critical industries. Thank you to all of the employers, agencies, legislators, everyone who is working on this project and continues to work on this project, and for all of their efforts. So thank you very much.
That was exciting. Did anybody request a fiscal note on this bill?
I believe one has been requested, but because it's an appropriation plus some agency money, I believe that we'll see that probably in jobs.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, now that we have Representative Norton here, I really wanted to do a special thank you for all of the work that she did on the many, many meetings, and I think she'd attended nearly all of them, and I just want to thank you so much and for your input along the way. So I wanted to acknowledge you and thank you. We both were very appreciative to the guidance and the work that you did. And she's even added as an author now, so we're very proud to have you aboard. And back to, thank you so much, Jessica. One thing I wanted to say while you're still here is if you turn, and I'm sorry there's not page numbers on here, but it's about halfway through. If you look at the pyramid, if you find a pyramid in there that has everything filled out from the top to the bottom, that symbolizes or shows you that those competencies have been completed, and so there's agreement across industry. Right now, they have 6 of the competencies of the 15 that are done and ready to go. And we've, in the legislation, we basically have said that when the competency is done and completed, that's when the grant can be available. So we're not trying to get ahead of it. We're waiting until industry can agree, until the competencies and all of these different components of it can be completed before the grant is available. But as they continue to do their work and as Dolly continues to work through this and get the competencies done, getting through all 15, then that will be available for the grant. So just so that's clear as well.
Representative Barrett, you have a question?
Two quick questions, or one really. To any of you, but is this in the Governor Dayton's budget? And if it is, great. If not, does he support the concept, if you know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, is not in the Governor's budget. And therefore, as an agency, we are really excited about the work and we are committed to doing this work, but we're not asking for additional fiscal support to do this work at this time because it's not in the Governor's budget.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative.
This is Representative Isaacson. I have been in contact with the governor's office about it, and they are excited about it. They're not going to say one way or the other how they're going to work on it, but they have been very open to working with me and keeping them apprised of what's going on, especially considering there's a little difference between the House and Senate versions. And
so, thank you.
Mr. Chair, with that, if I could bring up Kim Babine from DEED, and she can just talk about her component of it and what DEED will be doing to administrate the grants.
I have a question for Ms. Loman.
Oh.
We have a question from Ms. Loman, Representative Mahoney.
There's two questions here. I don't know if one can be answered at any time, but I'm wondering if you can name the 15 areas of competency that you're working on. So, I mean, you've got 4 here, so I'm going to go with agriculture. That's everything from putting the seeds in the ground to butchering it and put it in a, and so I'd kind of like an idea of that, and if you don't have it with you, you could send that or you could just have it ready for the next committee. The other one is a question to Ms. Lohman about the agency not having had any money in its budget for this, and then just proceeding. So could you tell the committee so that we, if the rest of us really want the agency to do a bunch of work without funding it, we'd know how far we could go. So could you give me an idea how many hours you and your staff have put into this?
Ms. Loman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you for helping me. Let me do the second one first. Thank you for helping me clarify that. There was an appropriation for the pipeline project in this in this current fiscal year. We are currently working under the budget that was appropriated by the legislature for the pipeline project, and that was $250,000 that we are using in order to convene all of the industry councils and do all of the competency standard work. We are doing that right now with those dollars. Those dollars do expire June 30th. So I did want to clarify that, that we're, for this work going forward, we haven't asked for any additional resources. And that may limit the amount of work we're able to continue to do going forward. We currently have a project manager and one project staff who are working on, who are dedicated to working on this pipeline project. We have, as I said, we've convened, probably 20 meetings at this point at various facilities. One of the meetings we were able to go down to Mayo Clinics, which was really excellent because they hosted us and we were able to have our industry council meeting there. But it is a big endeavor, so I appreciate you pointing out that we need resources in order to do big endeavors at the state.
Mr. Chair, just to that point.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, sorry. So, Representative Mahoney, there is an appropriation. There is an appropriation line for them to continue their work in our bill. We don't have a fiscal note yet to know how much that will be, but we will definitely, that will be the top of the priority list. They will make sure, we'll make sure that they get their money to do the work so that we can have the competencies completed so that we can do the grant program. So that is a part of the bill. We just don't have an appropriation dollar amount because we don't know what the fiscal has said yet.
Mr. Chair, the question I would really love to know is how much time was put into this by the agencies, because I think, Mr. Chair, you know as well as I do that members come forth to a finance chair or to a policy chair and say, well, this really wouldn't be a problem. The agency can absorb this. And what happens is the agency does do our work that we ask them to, but we are asking people to work. We've gotten them on a contract or whatever for 40 hours, and they end up working 50 hours a week. And that people may say, well, that's what business is. Just keep in mind that when you ask them to do something, it costs money.
And I appreciate that statement very much.
Yeah, well, last year I got in a lot of trouble for it.
Mr. Chair.
Well, funding it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. And Representative Mahoney, I appreciate that. And that was in the bill from the very beginning, and we absolutely will make sure that they get what they need to continue the work, because honestly, nothing can happen until the competencies are completed, and that's how the bill is constructed, because we want to keep it contained into things that are agreed upon by industry and actually can be helpful. So it's we're very committed to doing that.
Mr. Chair, to answer the second part of Representative Mahoney's question, I actually do have the list of occupations that we're currently working on, and they just got handed out. Fantastic. If there's anybody who wants to ask any questions specifically about those, but the exciting part about it is that, as you can see, many of them are already completed, and we're working on the validation of those with industry, and those will be ready to really explore dual training delivery systems very soon. And I just want to state again how much we appreciate the work of industry in really helping us get as far along as we've gotten, and their commitment. We couldn't have done it without it. So,
thank you very much. Any other commissioners? Representative Norton?
Not a question, Mr. Chair, but just to kind of follow up on Representative Mahoney's question. If you have a chance to look at the book, we met, I think I was up here 3 and sometimes 4 days a week for half a day to work on this for each of the industries, for multiple meetings for each industry. It was a lot of time over the summer. But the exciting part was that the department facilitated really wonderful meetings, and I think there was learning. Sometimes they went a little better than others. But if you look at some of these competencies and look through the book as to how we got those, we started with the list for almost all of the four areas that was much, much longer. And after all the industry folks weighed in and we pared it down, and we were supposed to try to pare it down to, I think, 3 and sometimes it'd be 4 or 5, it was really hard to do. I thought there were some really interesting things, and for this committee in particular, herd management, agronomists, there was a lot of stuff that's really of interest to rural Minnesota, and one of the more exciting things that kind of came out of that meeting had to do with the agriculture, which was, for those of you who are on some of the committees that this bill traveled through last year, and it didn't do as much in the House as it did the committee hearings as it did in the Senate, was ag was added at the end. It was kind of a last-minute actually addition that came through the committee process. Somebody said, well, why aren't we doing this for ag? And these jobs have spun out of that committee, and they're one of the ones that might be ready to roll out first. And you know, Ms. Lemon can talk about that, but we had a nonprofit, I think it's the pork industry, a nonprofit group who is ready to help support a dual education enterprise with our schools because of the needs in Greater Minnesota. And so, and all of these, we will have a component for Greater Minnesota, but particularly those ag ones, it was really interesting to see those kind of come alive in the committee. And just might also be worth mentioning that there are many other careers that did not make this list in those four areas that are kind of the next step, I think. If we can take this to the next step and move it along, there's lots of other careers that could use competency work ahead. So the department not only did a lot of work, they still have a lot of work to do, which is why it was so important that these guys added the component to actually fund the department so that we're complete and ready to go before we start giving funds to businesses.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. We appreciate all the work you did.
Thank you very much.
And we appreciate you being here. And Representative O'Neill or Isaacson, who you got next?
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to have Kim Babine come from D to kind of just give us a little synopsis as to what they would do once the grant's in.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Actually, it's just about yours, too, isn't it?
Not at all, sir. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Kim Babine. I am the Director of Government Affairs at DEED. Thank you to Representative O'Neill and Isaacson for inviting me to speak a little bit today about DEED's portion of this bill. I do want to acknowledge that DEED is excited about the work that has been done and hopefully will continue at least through the end of this fiscal year and hopefully into the future on the competency standards. We think it's a really useful exercise and a useful tool as in our job training workforce development programs moving forward. As I have said before in this committee, and I'll say again, DEED is always interested in looking at new ways to conduct job training, workforce development to make sure that we have a skilled workforce, that we are meeting the needs of employers. We are looking to be responsive to changes in our economy and with our workforce so that we can achieve those goals. While this program isn't in the governor's budget, we hopefully have conveyed to you that this is a commitment of the governor, job training and workforce development, and that we are working to meet the needs of those employers. We're evaluating this one in light of other proposals at the legislature and with current DEED programs, so that while we know that there are a variety of tools that are needed to meet the training needs, we want to be responsible with taxpayer dollars and make sure that we don't have redundancies or overlap. So we are open to looking changes that might be made to existing programs to accommodate these new approaches instead of creating additional programs if it's possible. And we look forward to working with Representative O'Neill, Representative Isaacson, Sam Norton, others who have worked on this moving forward. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, any questions from Ms. Babine? Representative Mahoney.
I'm not sure I heard Ms. Babine correctly. It sounded like you were looking at creative ways to fund this, and you were looking at all programs. What did you mean by that, I guess? Did you mean, because one of my further questions, and I'll give Representative O'Neill a little time here to come up with her answer. You know, we have 165 training programs in the state. Has anyone looked at what training programs might be replaced by this? And if that's for Representative O'Neill, for me to Ms. Babine, is that what you're doing? Is that what you were implying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we are at the department are looking not necessarily what would be replaced, but if there are any that are currently in place that could be augmented to bring in the competency standards, bring in the other goals of this grant program, more so than hopefully creating a new one. If that's not possible, then yes, there would be need for a brand new standalone program.
Representative Mulry. Excuse me.
Wow.
Mahoney. My apologies.
Second time
that just happened.
That's the second time.
Mr. Chair, you're just lucky we're on tape.
Did I apologize very loudly, you mean?
Yeah. Ms. Babine, this is a dual training model that incorporates MNSCU system and only MNSCU system in this bill. And the dual training program, for all that I've read about it, is exceedingly complex and very focused. To take these competency requirements and overlay them into another program is more than a little problematic to me. If you're going to do one, do the one right, and don't try and fragment it and place it into other little things, because I'm not sure it'd work out. That's just my thoughts.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have MNSCU here now that would like to speak maybe directly to what Representative Mahoney was just concerned about and how they would, they've actually given this quite a bit of thought in how to make this work and work well. And I believe I think Representative Dill might have an amendment in a little bit pertaining to, we'll probably deal with it after we have this testimony.
Yep, be fine.
Thank you, Chair Guenther, Representative O'Neill, for inviting us here today. My name is Joel Mulford. I'm the Minnesota State College and University System Director for Industry Partnerships. I'll let my colleague introduce himself.
Good afternoon. I'm Mike McGee. I'm an academic dean. I have the manufacturing, math, and science programs under my watch at Hennepin Technical College, which is the largest of the standalone technical colleges in the MNSCU system.
Again, I just want to thank Representative O'Neill, Representative Isaacson for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 551 here today. We feel like this is one of those leading efforts to support both Minnesota employers and workers. And I speak in support and specifically to House File 551's support of the incumbent worker training and through being delivered through alternative learning models. I believe this bill will have a direct benefit to an employee's need for continuous learning, the benefits of learning while earning, and finally the longer-term opportunities for upward mobility. From what I hear from employers, this upward mobility is critically important as it opens up new opportunities for maybe lesser-skilled employees and also the opportunity for long-term mobility within the organization and the competitiveness of the workforce at that organization. If enacted, the bill would be supported by a historically significant part of the Minnesota State College and University system. Last year alone, our system served approximately 160,000 people through alternative learning models and our customized training continuing education, and so we've got a robust capacity in that area. We delivered approximately 3,200 training contracts to businesses and different organizations during that same period. Dual training models are a proven learning model and, in my opinion, most powerful when conducted in alignment with a higher education institution that aligns those training experiences with continued opportunities in certificate, diploma, and degrees. This program will support that type of alignment, and I think wisely. The bill also allows for the retention of the learning experience and the materials in the public higher education system while allowing for customizing approaches to the delivery of the training at the employer site. This approach will allow our system to share those experiences across multiple employers and employees and brings us in on the front end of the program development and not attempting to connect with student experiences after the training experience. You know, one example of this kind of dual training and alignment that's been conducted recently, it was recognized in the customized training pilot program that was enacted in 2013. I believe it was House File 729. And the bill supported four pilot programs to work on developing learning models in support of both employees and employers. I want to introduce, as Dean Mike McGee had introduced himself, to talk a little bit about that as Mike shepherded that program along at Hennepin Technical College.
Mike McGee again from Hennepin Technical College. Just by way of background, I have about 28 years in higher ed, but prior to that I was a practitioner. We have 1,000 students in manufacturing programs at Hennepin Tech. We make connections every day with employers, and we work to build capacity in our training, both on the customized side and on the credit side. Manufacturing is a lifeblood industry in Minnesota, so alternative funding streams allow us to do things that we ordinarily can't do. 2 years ago, we received some funding in Representative Isaacson's bill allowed us to, the timing was really good. We had a quality assurance program coming online that was a high demand program by industry and not replicated anywhere in the state, and that seed money, if you will, allowed us to procure some equipment and make some partnerships and sponsor some students that went out into industry and were very, very successful. So I saw that bill, or see that bill, as akin to Representative O'Neill's bill. I think it's particularly important now, with employment numbers where they are, that incumbent workers would have access to improved skills and even apprenticeship, which creates career pathways for workers and improves performance and increases wages. This bill provides the incentives and the connections, really building capacity in our education and employment partnerships that will customize the delivery of training to meet competency standards. These workers will in turn move up in their skills, move up in their wages, and create opportunities for entry-level workers. And so that circle is complete. I think today apprenticeship is really coming back into vogue again, just with our trades, but in all the areas that this bill mentions. And I think it's particularly important for us at Hennepin Tech, where we work very hard to try to attract young people to manufacturing careers and industry careers, and I think this is a great incentive for them. Thank you.
Questions from the membership? Representative Norton?
Well, this isn't a question. I don't know if Representative, you want, I saw Representative Mahoney
go
say
ahead.
Okay, well, I was just, I wanted to mention, one of the things this bill is focused on is just Minsky at this time. And, you know, folks at the table should know that a lot of this came about because of the University of Minnesota. And Representative Mahoney was on the first exchange with the university where we worked on this several years ago, and it took a while to get to where we are today on this. But in studying the German model, not only do schools like their equivalent to Minsky participate in this, but they also have University of Applied Science, where four-year colleges do the same thing. And it's interesting, and I think we just need to keep an open mind to the possibilities that a University of Minnesota or any of our four-year colleges could find a business to sponsor a student for the full 4 years of their education and have that dual training go on the whole time. So while this bill right now is limiting to Minsky, I don't think it is outside the realm of possibilities that at some point we might want to open the doors. You know, again, it was the University of Minnesota that brought us to this issue, and we're here, frankly, where we are today because of their efforts. We need to be a little, perhaps be a little more creative rather than just think about it as a two-year program, that it could, in fact, be a four-year program.
Mr. Chair, to that point? And Representative Norton, I appreciate you saying that, and the Senate version is still open. And so we have a few differences between here and the Senate, and that's something that definitely Representative Isaacson and I have talked about at great length and are open to moving in that direction. And part of the reason, you know, why we do the committee work is so that we can hear from the committee and hear all those thoughts as well. So I just want to thank you for that and know that we are very open to move in that direction.
I have another question, but in response to Representative Norton's comments, I would hope that if we're using state dollars, we stay in state institutions for a length of time until the bugs are worked out. Any new program will have significant bugs in it, and if this moves forward, this is not a cheap program. I can't wait to see the fiscal note. I'm thinking somewhere in the $50 to $60 million range, but by the time you're done with it, and that's a lot of money, and I think it should stay in the state system. Whether it's the U of M or the Minsky, I don't really care, but I think state systems are a better place to go. My question is on page 3, line 20, not to exceed the cost of tuition up to 60 credits. What is the 60 credit? Is that a year's worth of college? Is that a year and a half? Is that 2 years? Is that...
That's 2 years, okay. Typically.
Okay. It's been a long time. I don't really always remember these things. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Got a couple of questions. we're going to be putting, as Representative Mahoney said, a significant amount of money into this. And generally what I find is when money comes from the state, there's strings attached as well. Is there anything that's going to be binding, any mandates that will be coming with this to businesses if they use this grant money?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Green. The only thing that we're asking is just their feedback on how the program worked for them. And so we're kind of looking for an ROI, but not an onerous ROI, because that was a concern for business as well. But really the only thing we want to know is tell us how it worked and, you know, how many – we're looking at numbers, like how many were – how much money was used, how many employees were trained, you know, what did their salary move from. But I can't think of any mandates that are in the bill. Okay, and Representative Isaacson.
The one thing that we did say was both the employer and the employee need to have some sort of agreement, and that's all we're asking. We're not mandating what the agreement is, just that we say there has to be some understanding of what the employment relationship's going to be, but we're not even trying to tell them what that should look like, and trying to stay out of that and be as little prescription as possible when it comes to that.
Representative North.
Well, let me weigh in on this a little bit. It's an answer to your question.
Okay.
One of the things that a dual education program does, and one of the things that we've been working so hard on since June, is to set up competencies. And yes, the business that signs up to participate in a dual education program will have a list of competencies that are assigned to them that they will have to take ownership to teach the students when they have them for those competencies. So this isn't just free money to hire a student. This is a responsibility to teach a curriculum, and they will agree to that curriculum ahead of time. But no one is forced to go into it. The employer is completely at their, you know, interest that they would participate in the program. But they are signing on to teach a curriculum and sign off on that in the end.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Green.
Can I respond to that? Would you mind?
I would say that it isn't a responsibility to teach a curriculum. It's a responsibility to partner in that curriculum. That Minsky has a large teaching role there too. So it's not just on the business, but the business does carry a part of that burden for sure. Okay.
Representative Green.
We have dual training out there already, and I know because I'm a big fan of it. And right now, businesses are participating in it at their own expense. And so I'm wondering if we really need this, and do you have any estimates of how many people will jump into this as a result of the grant program?
Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green. You know, when I was working with the Senator Bonhoff and her team over there, we were kind of trying to decide, you know, again, there's an outreach component to this too, so the businesses know. But I think because business has been at the table and have been a part of competencies and their associations have been a part of it, some of that work has been done organically. It is you know, we do need to think about the fact that this is a grant program and we'll have a set appropriation for that grant. In other words, we'll decide, is that going to be $2 million, $3 million, $5 million, $10 million? So it's not an endless pot of money. It's not that kind of an appropriation. So we don't know what our budget targets are yet, and this will land over in the Jobs and Energy Committee. And then at that point, I believe we'll have a better idea as to how much money we can put towards the appropriation of the grant program. But it's not an endless grant. But maybe Minsky could speak more to, like, how much, you know, what kind of interest that they've had through this process as well. You have another thing?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, while there are several types of dual training programs out there, there is no question not only is there a need, but there's an appetite for it when you look at the amount of folks that came together to make something like this occur, especially from the industry side, the chamber side, and many of the legislators and educators. So I don't think there's any question that there's a need for it. I think that, you know, where we would ask for some leeway is as we figure it out, as Representative Mahoney said, you know, there's going to be some kinks in the beginning, and we're learning how this works. And but I don't think we can, I think we can definitively say when we look at the need there is for skilled workers in the workforce across the state of Minnesota, there's no question that there is a thirst for this right now in greater and metro Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question, but apparently Representative Norton wants to answer my last question, so if that would be all right.
That'd be fine, Representative Norton.
Well, I just wanted to weigh in. There are some wonderful, actually. Bueller Corporation has a fabulous dual apprenticeship program going on right now. Bueller actually pays for the full freight education at Dunwoody for, I believe, 3 full years, and they train on-site, and they have worked out a partnership with Dunwoody. Bueller is a German corporation who understands the value of what they're doing, and it's some that they take, believe they take six dual apprentice type kids every year, young people, and train them. They even teach German on site so that when they're done with their dual training, they also can be shipped over to Germany and help with the larger corporation. It's fabulous, but it's hit and miss around the state. And the one downside to what's happening at Bueller is those guys, when they graduate from their program, they're going to be trained for Bueller and work at Bueller. That's Bueller's hope, and that's what happens in Germany. But they don't necessarily have... they're not going to have the certification and certificate and recognized certificate in a profession quite in the same way we're hoping to roll out with this model. This will be specific jobs with specific titles, which will mean something to people and hopefully give them an opportunity to go to any number of locations, not just Bueller. But Bueller does take a chance. They educate these people, and they may not stay there. I don't know why they wouldn't, because they're getting a great education, an opportunity to travel internationally, and they're collecting a salary while they're going to school. So it is wonderful, and there are other, as you mentioned, options. But we're trying to grow it out and make it nation-leading. And I will say, I just sent the chairs and the staff, Laura got it too, a link to Brookings, who just published a paper, I think it came out this last week, about dual education in the state of Michigan and what they're doing. And we're every bit as far along, or maybe farther, because of the competency work we've done than Michigan. So it is moving in this country too, not just in Minnesota.
Okay. I have one more question and a comment. The other question that you can answer it if you can, otherwise we'll just let it go, but is there any cost to the students? And the last comment is, if you don't receive funding for this or don't receive adequate funding for this, have you considered changing the grant program into a tax incentive for the businesses instead? Is it something they wouldn't have to, they would have to apply for it, but they wouldn't be at the mercy then of how much money is there in the pool to take out of? Because I think this is well worthwhile. I think it's part of our future. So I hope that there's other avenues they can take.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Green. So the student, our hope is that the student wouldn't have to pay anything, which is why that we've asked for the employer and the employee to have some sort of agreement before they step into this, because the employer will have some skin in the game. They do, you know, if they are a business that makes, has a gross revenue of $50,000 or more, they're going to be putting in 66% of what, so the student will apply for state and federal grants, just as like as if they'd gone into any two-year program. And then the portion left over, the business would pay some and this grant would pay some. And so that's why we're asking the employer and the employee to at least talk about it before they get into the grant program. And they can check a box and say, we're not going to do a contract. But the students, they're not going to have skin in the game in the sense that they don't have to put money in. But we do hope that they stay at that business and that they are great employees for that business. And that's up to the employer and the employee, you know, in their contract. If the employer puts in a certain amount, maybe there would be an agreement that they stay a certain amount of time, but that's really up to the two of them. But through this program, the student wouldn't be putting anything in for tuition and fees. Obviously, they still have to make money to live, and as I have three kids in college, that's a lot of money just to, you know, support your own family. But is that hopefully the answer? I also have two more testifiers from the chamber. If you would like to hear from them as well. Unless there's any other questions for Minsky.
Representative O'Neill, can you want to tell me when you want the A1 amendment adopted in your
bill? We could probably address that as the testifiers are coming. So we could address the A1 as well.
Okay. I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A1 amendment. I have an oral amendment to the A1 amendment on line 1.12. After insert and semicolon comma, the word and should be A-N, strike the D, and the amendment is ready to go forward. Mr. Chairman, my work in this committee has been almost unilaterally representing Cook County in housing and now in this instance. Cook County has the Cook County Higher Education program that is a part of, that is funded by the state, partially funded by the state, and it's a very remote and rural educational opportunity to partner with MNSCU, and their funding goes through MNSCU as the fiscal agent, and they deliver projects, education based projects that are accredited both with the University of Minnesota, University of Wisconsin, State Scholastica, as well as MNSCU. And they also work with the employers to provide the kind of training that they need on site. And so this is a technical amendment to assure that they are then eligible to participate in this program. And both the author and the co-author before us have suggested that this is a friendly amendment.
Representative Isaacson.
The only part that I'm a little confused by is that I want to be clear that, and so if this does that, and I'd have to ask House Research if it does, that we are confining this still to a MNSCU-related organization, because what it says here is an educational provider, and I would say a MNSCU-affiliated education provider would be the friendly amendment that I'd be comfortable with. I don't see this language being as prescriptive as I'd like to see at that point, and maybe I can get a judge's ruling on that one.
Mr. Chairman, I depend on Ms. Newman for an interpretation of the proposal by Representative Isaacson.
I think it's
a benign addition.
Mr. Chair and Representative Deal and Representative Isaacson, I think that if you mean to confine it, as you suggested, that you probably need to modify education provider, and if a MNSCU-affiliated education provider is what does it, that would certainly be more precise than what's in here, because as it reads, an education provider could be a pretty broad.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to the amendment, and if there is a problem with that, and I don't think that there is, I can address that at a different time. So I would, the Isaacson amendment, verbal amendment to my amendment, I would accept as a friendly.
It will. With that, we will amend the amendment. You want to read it?
Mr. Chairman, the amended version of the amendment now would be on line 1.2 of the amendment, after insert, it would read a MNSCU-affiliated education provider.
Okay, Mr. everybody Chair? Understand the amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
As I was getting the amendment, because I didn't have it, but Representative Dill, could you possibly just explain the situation in which that this would apply? I know we had someone from Cook County come and talk to us. Did you give that background, or could you if you hadn't?
Sure, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
Cook County, of course, is up in the very tip part of the Arrowhead, a population of 5,000 or less people. It's 130 to 150 miles to the closest MNSCU location, whether that be Ely or the Iron Range or Lake Spear College down in the Duluth area. And so what they have embarked on as a nonprofit and working in concert with MNSCU is delivering MNSCU partnered projects and curriculums to people up in Cook County to save them from driving all the way to those places to receive education. My wife got her teaching degree, her final years of teaching, in Bemidji, where it was 85 miles each way. And that was a burden to our family. She got her degree, and she's been teaching, a tenured teacher. But now you're talking about 260 miles, at least, to 300 miles each way, and that's the reason for the partnership that's been in existence. And Cook County Higher Education has a base appropriation in our base budget now in the higher education bill that's ongoing. So I hope that explained that.
Any questions about the amended amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, the same change would also need to be made on line 1.3 of the amendment.
Yep. That's correct.
Okay. Any questions about the amendment?
No.
Mr. Chair? We're wondering, maybe Anita Newman can answer, wouldn't it need to go into Subdivision 3, the training institution section?
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, that was the amendment to the amendment on line 1.3 to make the same change would do that.
Yeah.
Very well. So,
Mr. Chair, are we clear that we're talking that just making it go into the right section, right? Of Subdivision 3, not Subdivision 1.
Mr. Chair and Representative Isaacson, the amendment that you have amends Subdivision 2 and Subdivision 3, and so by amending the amendment in both places would make that MNSCU affiliated in both places.
Representative Norton has a...
Well, this doesn't make sense to me. I understand what you're trying to do. I get that, but I'm not sure the change that we're making is getting. These are grants to employers, not to someone doing training. Through the employer. The eligible grantee is the employer.
No.
Yes, an employer organization is eligible to apply for a grant.
Right, yeah.
So I don't think the entity you're talking about is doing the same thing as the employer or the organization. But I agree with what you're trying to do. I understand it. I'm just not sure this is working.
Isaacson. For the sake of brevity, I know what he's trying to do, and I agree with it. I think most people do. We're going to bring this up in jobs. If you pass it, I'm committed to working with you to make sure the right amendment goes through. If we have some confusion now, I don't want to create any more problems.
Representative Dill.
Well, I'm willing to do that, and Cook County has their lobbyist here that could possibly clarify it for Representative Norton, but we'll wait until the next stop then.
Okay.
So are we amending the bill then, and or not amending the bill? That is the question.
Are we going to have this amendment go through, or are we going to wait till the next stop?
Mr. Chair, my preference would be, since this is rather confusing and we've had to amend it, I would prefer if we could just kind of talk offline, Representative Dill, and then we can come up with an amendment that's nice and clean and all the parties, because there's a lot of parties involved in this bill, as Representative Norton knows.
As Mr. Chairman, and that is fine with me. I'll withdraw the amendment as amended and amended. And I will accept the fact that I do not serve on the next committee, that this will be before, and that I'll depend on my colleague, Representative O'Neill and Isaacson, to get the amendment in, and Ms. Erickson, who's here today, will be following that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Being so understanding. Representative O'Neill, are we all done with the testifiers?
I actually have someone from the chamber here.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Radosovich. I'm here with Minnesota Chamber of Commerce as a policy analyst. And we've been engaged since this bill and project began last year. We were supportive of that bill, and we've been engaged in the stakeholder convenings with Dolly and industry since then. We're supportive of House File 551, and I want to thank Representatives O'Neill, Isaacson, and Norton for putting so much work into this. We're supportive of this fundamentally because we travel around the state, we talk to our members, and for 10 years or so, they've been telling us in increasingly urgent terms that they have a lot of trouble finding skilled workers. Many of the jobs that are sitting open require a 2-year technical degree or certificate, and they'll tell us things like, you know, not every student needs a 4-year degree. For many employers, many folks are realizing that we're now in a new hiring environment, one in which you can't just post a job opportunity and expect to get qualified applicants showing up at your door. This is a method that some people have referred to as the post and pray method, and it doesn't work anymore. So instead, it's an environment in which a business has to be actively involved in finding, recruiting, and training its own workforce. Representatives from 3M have been before other committees. They were not able to come today. But one thing that they've told us is that for most new employees at 3M, the folks coming in the door have already had contact with 3M in some other way, through an internship, a LinkedIn group, or some sort of connection. They're not just coming in cold off the street. As Representative Green pointed out, some companies do have dual training programs already. They hire entry-level workers with the understanding that those folks will work and pursue the related education at the same time and prepare to fill higher-level roles in the company. And some of these companies are already footing the bill or sharing the bill for employee education. But those are kind of the early adopters, and it's an expensive sort of approach to training workers. It takes a lot of upfront investment and faith. And so we think that this bill is a great pilot project. It's a great way to help propagate a very promising practice. It would help more employers try this approach, which requires upfront investment, a lot more upfront investment than they might be used to. So a couple of key details. We really like that this bill is focused on high-need, high-demand industries. And within that, it's focused on occupations that are likely to grow or facing workforce shortages. Second, it's important to us, and we like that what this bill does is it asks Dolly to identify standards where they exist already, national or international standards within industries, so that to the maximum extent possible, what the students come out with will be a widely recognized and transferable set of skills and credentials, with a little bit of customization that the company puts in through on-the-job training. Third, the requirement for skin in the game for employers. Employers have to put in at least a minimum percentage for the cost of the education. And so that ensures that that the state funds will be going to employers who are already willing to step up and make a significant investment in training their workforce. Overall, it's a great pilot effort, and we think it could help to grow a very promising practice in industries that face significant challenges right now. So thank you again for giving me this chance to speak on behalf of House File 551.
Thank you. Is there any questions for the person from the chamber? Seeing none, Thank you for your input very much. Representative O'Neill, you have anything else?
I have one final comment.
Oh, Representative Miller.
This is more comment, so it'll be very brief. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for bringing this. If there's one thing I'd like to change with this and other programs is I think the students do need to have some skin in the game. That's coming from someone who put themselves through a four-year Big Ten college on my own. And I think that there's an ownership that's important on the employee side when they find some sort of skin. You could argue what this, how much or things like that, but doing an extra job to be able to pay for training has value and reward and gives more ownership in that career path that they're going to take. The fear that I have is when we do this where we just provide these opportunities, we have people who say, well, this works well, it didn't work anymore for me, and they change a year later. And I think there's important decisions that need to be made by all the different people, the government in this, the employer and the employee, and I'd like to see the employee making sure that they're making a serious decision about this as well.
Representative O'Neill, you have a Mahoney, okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a couple of thoughts on this, on the presentation today, and some other thoughts. But first, I just want to congratulate you. This is only, I think, the second bill that didn't single out and eliminate the metro area. So thank you so very, very much. You know, it's nice to know that we're only the bastard, redheaded bastard stepchild in a few places, not in yours. Did I say bastard on tape?
You're paid to say that.
That's mollified by calling him another name.
It would be nice to see what you're considering the contract between the employer and the employee, because I think that's really important for us to kind of get an idea. And this is the committee that it should have been seen in, mm-hmm. rather than jobs, because that kind of. In the dual system in Germany, there is basically a contract that's signed, and both sides know what they're getting into early on, and it'd be nice to see that. I think Representative Norton was with over at in Germany. That's right. And the funny piece was as she spoke to the employer, employee, and people not leaving, there was a question. And this is more for Representative Green. So what do you do? And this was to a large 26,000 employee company. The CEO, that's how important, that's how they take this dual training over there. He came down to talk to us as a visiting group, just a bunch of legislators, state legislators. And one of the questions was asked, well, what do you do when someone leaves, that goes through the program and leaves? And it's always kind of funny when you stump the CEO of a billion-dollar company, and he had the head of training, and he had his executive vice president there, and he looked at one, he looked at the other, and he had this bewildered look on his face. And he looked at both, and he said, "Has that ever happened?" And both of them said no. So the program, if it works out and it's done correctly, they typically don't leave. And the skin in the game is, that's another story. I think we're coming into a different world. If we want to get people jobs, we're coming into a different world. We have to look at it differently. I would like some understanding, and maybe not right now because I know we have another bill, is this geared more towards, and how will it work with incumbent workers versus new trainees, new hires, and how these certifications kind of work? And I don't think it's real clear in here, and maybe that's coming, because you've kind of sold it as new workforce training, but I've heard so often from yourself and the testifiers of incumbent, basically without saying the actual word, is this is a training system for incumbent workers. All good. We do that already with the Job Skills Partnership. I'm happy to help businesses, whether they're in greater Minnesota or in urban Minnesota, and that's cities of the first class and everything else, find workers, so long as they're paid at a reasonable rate. And then the other question that I probably should have asked early on is, you know, what piece of this are our workforce centers not able to do? And if they're not able to do it, why aren't they able to do it? Because this is really a getting a worker or an incumbent worker into a training system. And that's what our workforce centers are supposed to do. They're supposed to help people get a new job, and if they need it, they're supposed to help them get training. And I believe that the workforce centers can send people to a Minsky institution and come up with tuition reimbursement. So that's something that you might want to be ready for in jobs, just a subtle hint. But, we can do this, this would be a great deal for Minnesota and the employers here. There are other states that are doing similar work, and that piece that was written in the, I've already read it, it's don't bother after page 27.
Or you can go right to the conclusion.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to bring a little comfort to Representative, is it Mahoney today? under subdivision 7, it'd be number 2 there. It defines some of the employers that would be eligible to for these grant programs, and it goes from $50 million to $20 million to down to $10 million. There's a lot of counties in the state that certainly don't have those employers that generate that type of revenue throughout their businesses. So the way I'm looking at this, this is actually geared towards the metro area rather than a lot of the rural areas in the state. So just a little comfort for you.
Still not helping.
Mr. Chair, there's a whole series of companies out there that reach that bottom number there around the state.
And Representative Mahoney, I will give you a list of all the bills that are equally applicable to the metro or rural. And it's more than 2.
Have Gunther at the top of the village.
Anything wrong with that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just address some of the concerns and points raised. First point, the skin in the game. And you had said something about the student having a second job. The part of the dual training is that is they're doing that job. So they're hired by this company, so they are working and they're learning as they go. So it's a learn. They're earning to learn or learning to earn or however which way we say that. So and they're not going to go get a part-time job on top of their full-time job and go to school. So this is a little different than, you know, when we were back in college, going to college. So just to point that out. And Representative Mahoney, where he went now? Well, his point about incumbent versus new hire, I would say it's both. It's both and it. And actually, the Minsky folks had a very good point of if we take an entry-level person, give them training, move them up to be a machinist, which is one of the highest needs, then that opens up another entry-level position that they can hire somebody else and move them up to machinist. And so it's kind of a whole flow of new hiring incumbent workers. It's both. I know Representative Mahoney asked about workforce centers and what they're able to do. And I would point out again, as Representative Norton had said many, many times over, that what's different about this is that we're putting into place competencies. So, you know, we all know what a plumber is. We all know what an electrician is because they have certifications and they have standards. So now we're going to translate that into these other competency areas so it's portable. And like I said, I think we are going to be leading the nation. So this is very, very different. And it's different than other dual training programs because of that, and it's different than what the workforce centers do. So I think, you know, if you look at these, the pyramids in your handouts, it's really important to understand what we're creating here. We're creating something really groundbreaking, and it's really exciting to be a part of it. And so we are it's very different work than what the workforce centers do. And Representative Isaacson wants to add something.
Responding to Representative Mahoney, the one thing that makes a difference in between workforce development and not is that we want to encourage Minsky to become more responsive to the job community as it's regionally based across our state. And this bill gives them the tools they need to do that. If we don't, then we're going to go back into the problem we had with that the Commissioner of Dolly talked about, which was that train and then look for the job issue. And this bill allows MNSCU to sidestep that problem by helping them be incorporated through the competencies directly to where the needs are in the job community. And I think that's something fundamentally different from what we expect from our Workforce Development Fund, and it brings MNSCU into the game much more succinctly than it did before. So I think that's a really important point to kind of highlight when we're answering that question.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, thank you. I'm supportive of what you're doing, but I want to correct something. Perhaps talking about when I was a dinosaur back in college is the bad example, so I'm going to go with a more current one. My wife is currently working full-time as a teacher at a college. She works part-time as a nurse at a clinic. She's taking care of our house while I'm having all the fun here in St. Paul when I'm gone for most of the week. And number four, she's going to school to improve her education so that she can get a better job. So it is possible for people to have a stake in the game. I can't pick on Representative, what'd you call him, Mulaney or something?
You can bring it up.
Okay. Representative Mahoney, it's on record. I just wanted to, but I hope things aren't changing times to where people can't try and put some sort of stake in the game into things.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Isaacson.
You know, I think that I understand what your example is, and there's no doubt that we all agree we respect what we earn. But I think that it goes back to another question. Two, one, there's a real serious issue in this area of making sure we have enough employees working to sustain a manufacturer renaissance. But the second part of it is that, you know, I would challenge the paradigm that you use exactly with your wife with the following. Why are we creating barriers for people to get their education? And by requiring students in this situation to have to work as hard as your wife does, or other students having to work two or three jobs while trying to go to school because education has become unaffordable in some ways, is creating barriers. So my response would be they do have skin in the game. The student's skin in the game is their future and their livelihood and their career. And I think that's just a different version of skin in the game than what you're referring to, but no less important or valid.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton has a question.
I don't know if it was stated. I would just...
Or state.
For folks who haven't been in this game, haven't been digging around in this, in Germany, and we hope here, these kids... it's not work study. They work a 40-hour week and get paid for a 40-hour week while they're going to school. It's all year round. It's not just including summers. I mean, it is a full-time job plus. That's what the program's designed for. So, you know, unlike work study, which is, you know, during a semester or part-time, or what I used to do, which is work in the summer, save up all my money, and then have it gone the first class I took. But, you know, this is a different model. This is literally a 40-hour work week and going to school too, doing it in a variety of different ways, but it's all year round, all the time. They're a full-time hired employee with the business that takes us on.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, also the skin in the game should be pointed out that that's the point of the employer-employee contract, and so if the employer's putting money in, you know, they can have an agreement to say, well, you know, I'll work here 6 months, and if I don't work here 6 months, then I'll pay some back. Whatever their agreement happens to be, but that also is a component where they can have some skin in the game. There's an option anyway.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, Representative Isaacson, I want to thank you for this. What I'm just seeing and reading this and what I'm hearing the explanation, this is what this state needs. I have numerous businesses in my district that are desperate for employees. I have one that made a huge expansion that required 50 employees. They cannot find any. They're doing whatever they can to try to get through the contracts that they have. They're doing everything they can. This is a way that's going to help them. I've also met with the construction trades people. They are scared because they need to find employees to fill the positions and the openings they have. So with this, what this is going to do, it's going to fill a lot of holes that we have, because we, not just in private sector, but everywhere, we are in dire need of skilled labor. And this is going to help that. Thank you.
Seeing no more questions from the membership, Representative O'Neill, want to renew your motion?
Yes, Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 551 pass and be referred to the Jobs Committee.
Very well. Everybody wants to have that be part of the day. This is a very exciting bill. It really is. I am excited about both of the authors' bills this year. It's a kind of a great year to fulfill the workforce development part of our title. So with that, all in favor of passing House File 551, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion carries. Thank you for the good presentation. I'm glad we could be a practice for the next committee.
Members, we have before us House File 1878. Representative Gunther has. Representative Gunther, you're going to move your bill to Jobs, I guess. Would you like to move your bill?
That's correct.
Proceed.
Okay, members, this is a bill that was brought to me by the initiative funds, and it provides a sustainable supply of high quality child care that is vital part of rural economic development. Rural communities must address and supply a supply of quality child care in order to attract and retain young workers and maintain vibrant communities in greater Minnesota. High quality child care directly impacts employment and productivity. Working parents cannot maintain productive employment without affordable quality child care. The Minnesota Initiative Foundations, in partnership with the First Children's Finance, are seeking economic development resources to expand their outreach to child care programs in greater Minnesota. Investments will be used to develop community solutions action plans through rural communities planning process, engage the private sector to create local sustainable resources, and lead child care learning cohorts to sustainable and grow local child care businesses. Increase the number of rural child care programs participating in Parent Aware. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to introduce, if I can find the list of names, which it should be here somewhere, of my testifiers that I just met. Go ahead and introduce yourself, whoever wants to speak first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Regine Hansen. I'm the Vice President of the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation. And on behalf of the six initiative foundations in the state and First Children's Finance, I'm here to support this bill. Our foundations work to create economic prosperity and community vitality within each of our regions. And we do that by focusing on entrepreneurship and early childhood, programs that are really critical to our economic growth. Our early childhood goals are to invest in efforts so children are ready to learn and succeed, which leads to strong families, stronger workers, and stronger communities. Each initiative foundation in the state has worked in partnership with First Children's Finance on quality child care programs for the past couple of years, and we've built some really great training programs that cover community solution action plans. They engage the private sector, they build business learning cohorts, and we increase the participation in Parent Aware. but there's a lot of more work that needs to be done because there's a huge shortage of child care providers. There's a huge shortage of trainers and programs for the providers. There's a lack of knowledge of resources for quality and business skills on behalf of the providers. So we've supplied a couple of graphics that I encourage you to look at. And one graphic is actually of a program that we do in the southern part of our state that we've done in 8 of our 20 counties that we serve. We have over 2,000 licensed family child care providers, and that's where the majority of our children are in for care. And so that's why we are promoting this program and hope to get continued funding with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Jost. I work for West Central Initiative, one of the 6 Minnesota Initiative Foundations. I'm the early childhood coordinator there, and I have actually worked in early childhood for 42 years. And we have a growing shortage of child care providers. And along with that, we have a need for high-quality child care. And when you think about rural communities, child care really is an integral part of the community. It's one of the largest industries in our state and in our small communities. And it also makes sure that other parents can go to work. So it really is a kind of a dual benefit of child care. So we have a workforce of child care providers, but we're also allowing other parents to go to work in other industries. So it really is a vital part of our communities. And we do need more child care providers, and it's really time intensive to encourage people to go into child care, to improve the quality of child care, because it's not a high-paying job, and so not everybody's knocking at the door to get into child care. So it really does take a lot of effort to get people involved in the child care industry. So I am here just to say that I also support this bill, the House File 1878. Thank you.
You have one more testifier? Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Heidi Hagel-Braid from First Children's Finance. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony about House File 1878 this afternoon. As I mentioned, my name is Heidi Hagel-Braid from First Children's Finance, where I am the Regional Director for Minnesota and the Dakotas. First Children's Finance is a national nonprofit organization based here in Minnesota. And our mission is to help children, families, and communities thrive by increasing the availability, affordability, and quality of early care and education. We work solely on the business side of child care, ensuring that child care businesses remain stable and sustainable over the long term. 18 months ago, we established a unique and innovative partnership with the 6 Minnesota Initiative Foundations. The initiative is called the Greater Than MN Project. It focuses solely on rural child care issues in Greater Minnesota. I've provided some background materials about the project for you today. They look like this. One of the things that you'll see are actually the plans, the Community Solution Action Plans that are attached inside of that document. Child care businesses, which are small businesses, play critical roles in the greater Minnesota regional economies. It is an economic sector with facilities, employees, and links to other industries. It is a public good that enables families to be at work and to be productive at work. And it is part of the educational system that supports the development of children, which are our next generation of workers. Child care is an economic multiplier. For every dollar spent on child care, it results in other business activity. A sustainable supply of high-quality child care is a vital part of rural economic development. The Greater Than MN project has three distinct phases. The first one is a community solution action planning process where we bring together a diverse group of stakeholders from each community to develop a plan of action about how to address child care challenges that are unique to that rural community. It results in a community solution action plan, five of which you will see examples included in the handouts for you today. The second phase of the project is the establishment of a business advisory council, where we bring representatives from the private sector, from school districts, from chambers, from DEED, from all over the place to engage in the plan to address child care shortages or challenges. And it really is about attracting and retaining young families in rural Minnesota, making sure that we are not exporting our young families and young workers out of rural communities. And then finally, the other phase that happens concurrently is that we establish business learning cohorts for child care businesses, both family child care businesses based in homes and child care centers, really ensuring that we have a skilled workforce enabled to maintain and perform profitable child care businesses over time. What I want to draw your attention to is actually the back page of the handout that I provided for you. Here is, in the 18 months that our project has been live, some of the benchmarks that we've been able to hit so far. We have had over 315 different community members from 15 counties that have resulted in five community solution action plans. And to date, we have over 275 family child care providers and child care center professionals engaged in the learning cohorts across the state. There are 16 of them occurring right now, eight of them in eight different communities throughout the state. We have 50 business leaders, which include chambers of commerce, economic development, local entities and employers that have been engaged in the community solution action planning processes and bringing support and resources to the growth of their community. And then finally, the project has had an enormous and incredible response. Since 2013, October 2013, we have had over 2,800 hits on the project management website from over 41 different states in the country. And there are 125 people watching what's happening on Twitter to us all of the time. We have had, in a very short amount of time, an incredible response to the project, and I believe that part of our success lies in the fact that we're empowering rural communities to become engaged in developing solutions at a local level and connecting their child care sectors with their own private sector representatives and resources. In closing, I ask for your support of 1878. I believe this work has the potential to change the landscape of child care in Greater Minnesota and to contribute to the creation of vibrant rural communities. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you, and if we can be of assistance, please don't hesitate to contact us about the project.
Are there any questions?
That's okay, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Moran.
So I am a strong advocate of early childhood education and realize that we don't have nearly enough child care providers for the needs of so many parents. But as I look at this, I'm unable to see a clear path as with this bill as a way to recruit or build or to have more child care providers in the rural community. So can you create this clarity for me? Anyway.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, I'll take the share the example of Stevens County has a shortage of child care providers, and since they've been doing this project, they've had an increase in child care providers, and it's young providers who are really interested in trying to figure out from the get-go how to provide the best care and how to stay in business so that they aren't starting out with no help. Once upon a time, I was a child care provider, and we didn't have those sorts of supports, and so I had to figure out everything on my own. And it would have been really easy to give up after a year. And with this support and help, it's so much easier to stay in business than when you're out there all on your own. And the other thing about being a, especially family child care provider, you almost, you often don't feel valued. And this is helping to show the value of child care in a community. And so we get everyone involved. And it's not just the provider's issue. It's an issue of our communities, our business people, our families. And so it really helps support that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I'm looking at, so the goal was to, for the state to give six private sector entities money to facilitate a planning process, engage the private sector to invest, provide some resources and training, and then to recruit some to recruit child care programs to participate in the Parent Aware. And a couple of those is really touches child care providers who are already in business to help them sustain their business, you know. But I'm really feeling challenged about bringing in new providers with what we're doing with the money that we are dedicating to the private sector. I'm you know, even saying to businesses, you know, you yourself, open, you know, provide child care for your employees. I mean, that would be something that could be done or should be done, or would really support families who are working for those businesses in those areas if those businesses themselves were providing some kind of, you know, child care. But I'm really feeling challenged here trying to see the benefit. I think it's a good bill. You know, I believe in early child education. I know it's really unaffordable. Parents cannot afford it. We need it. We want kids to be ready and prepared to enter into kindergarten. But I just can't see clearly the path of bringing in opportunities for more daycare centers to be available for families in the rural community.
Ms. Yost.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, I live in Ottertail County, and right now there are so many business people and business people in the government, really city government in Fergus Falls, talking about the shortage of child care. And so we are starting to, along with First Children's Finance, have meetings around the county to talk about this shortage and what we're going to do about it. So hopefully we will be recruiting new providers, whether that be family child care or center care. So they're looking to us to help them figure out how to fill that shortage, how to fill that gap of child care.
Representative Moran.
And the cost is $1.5 million to do that? Where did that number come from?
Who would like to take that?
Mr. Chair, if I can also just circle back to Representative Moran's question. So what happens in the Community Solution Action process really is based on and customized toward the rural community's specific needs. And those who are struggling with recruitment, that becomes their planning process. And that's where all of the resources then flow. So what you're seeing as examples may not be communities who selected that as their primary focus, but it can be and should be in the communities in which recruiting new child care providers is a major priority. And so when you sort of break down those numbers, the $1.5 million would be about $750,000 per year. And between First Children's Finance and the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, we're talking about six different regions across the state. Our work at First Children's Finance would be about $80,000 per region to be able to do the Business Advisory Council, the Community Action Planning process, and also the Learning Cohorts, which is providing all of the training and technical assistance to the businesses. And then the remaining balance of that would, the Minnesota Initiative Foundations would use that to sort of round out, and I would certainly defer to them to talk about their plans for those dollars.
So one more to the testifier, I forget, what's your name again? This is to you. It sounds like this is something that you guys have been doing out of tails. You've been doing it, and you've been doing it without, well, I don't know, how have you been doing it?
Ms. Yost.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran. We have been, well, first of all, we don't do this alone. We always have partners, so Child Care Aware, First Children's Finance, business people are there. But they look to us as a neutral partner to bring people together to help figure out how do we make sure that there's enough child care in our communities and enough high-quality care in our communities. So we're all a little different. We do all sorts of work around early childhood, so this is one piece of the work that we do. And in West Central Initiative, we have two full-time people that work in early childhood. And that can be anywhere from oral health, early childhood mental health, to the parent aware work. And so right now we pay for that through our initiative foundation.
And last question, I guess. So why are you not included in this bill? You've been doing the work. You have the partnerships. You have the relationships out there. You know, why are you not included on this initiative? Why are we bringing in six private sector entities to do this work?
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, I work for the initiative.
You work for the initiative?
Yeah, I am the early childhood coordinator for West Central Initiative, which is one of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations, which covers the entire rural part of Minnesota. So each of us have a certain region, and ours is the West Central part.
Ms. Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out a little bit about our program, the graphic that I pointed to. And I'm from the Southern Initiative Foundation, and we have 20 counties. And we have many communities that a lot of these providers are in very isolated situations. And I can give you, we've done this program in 8 of our counties, so it's a year-long process. And sometimes providers are involved in a longer period of time if they're going for greater points for parent aware and that type of thing. But when we did it in a small town such as Wells, Minnesota, where, you know, the population is 1,500 people, we went to that community and did that and partnered with Child Care Aware and First Children's Finance and the local school district and everything. And so we had 16 licensed family providers, which may not sound like a lot, but in this very small town, that is a lot. And 14 signed on to continue to go through this year-long process with us. So we provide curriculum that's approved by the state. We train them in the curriculum. We provide mentoring. We'll go into their home and talk to them about, if they so choose, talk to them about how their child care is set up, you know, as far as toys and, you know, all different kind of things. So it's a long process that they go through, and it's professional development, it's mentoring, it's, you know, the business track when they go through that. So, and there's many, many providers in greater Minnesota. So a lot of times I think people think about the child care centers, and we work with child care centers too, but we just don't have as many of those in greater Minnesota.
So
Representative Moran.
This is building on what happened in 2014. I think in 2014, it was given $2.85 million as part of supplemental budget to the foundations, initiative foundations, in 2014. So coming out in this bill with the hope that you get the $1.5 million, what would be your goal? Where do we go from here? Where do you want to see yourself at as you receive more funding?
Thank you. Speaking from the Initiative Foundation mm-hmm. point of view, and not just the early childhood part mm-hmm. of the Initiative Foundation, we're a foundation, and so we raise money in order to operate our programs, and, mm-hmm. and our particular foundation focuses on economic development. Entrepreneurship and early childhood is a perfect match. And so in order to implement our programs, we have to get the funds to do that. And we do get some, you know, annual funding from the McKnight Foundation, but in order to make an impact in our region, you know, funding is what it takes in order to implement these programs.
What's the impact?
The impact is, like, in early childhood, it's more kids are ready for kindergarten, and they have the, you know, stronger learning, and so then in the end, they make stronger workers and build to our stronger communities.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, in the interest of time, I'm going to probably have to cut this off because we got other meetings to go to. One thing that I would like, if you would be willing to email out to this committee, is what your total budget is, how this $1.5 million will be dispersed up between your agencies, because I assume that's where it's going. Excuse me. And a list of how many people you've helped and the ones that you have, if they're still in business. With that, I am going to let Representative Gunther renew his motion.
I will renew my motion to have House File 1878 be passed and sent to Jobs Committee.
Representative Gunther renews his motion to move House File 1878 to Jobs. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Nobody go anywhere just yet. This is our last meeting, and I was going to ask Representative Gunther if he wants to come and gavel out and thank the pages himself.
Well, we, believe it or not, ran out of bills. And it's kind of a good thing. We did it in the last day. And there is one bill pending, and that's what made me think of Mullery, because he asked for a bill to be sent to this committee. But it didn't fit this committee, so we didn't take his bill. But so this will be our last meeting in a policy committee. You'll have a little time off now at this time slot. And I want to thank our pages, Anna and Barb. You've worked very well with us. Thank you very much. And our other staff that we have monitoring this committee, it's been very nice. You have been very, very helpful. And you just won't give me those Democrat talking points.
I have the same as ours anyway.
But anyway, Anita is always the backbone of this committee, and I really appreciate her. So with that, Representative Norton, the Democrat has something to say.
Thank you to everyone. It's been interesting. I just have a question kind of procedurally. You know, we've done a lot of great work, and we've heard a lot of bills in this committee. Actually, most of them have been bipartisanly supported and moved along. And now they, because of the way that you guys have structured, they go to Jobs. And I'm wondering, do you have any hope to have some of us who served on this policy, Greater Minnesota aspect of it, to be able to serve on any conference committees or be a part of any decision making in the future? Because it sort of is hard to...
I hope we do that. I really do. Representative Garofalo is very willing to accommodate this thing. In fact, we will have an omnibus policy bill put into his bill, and you will all get a copy of that. Any suggestions of what should be put in it, please send them to us.
Well, it would be nice, Mr. Chair, if at some point, you know, I'd be happy just to sit down with you to represent, you know, my folks here as you move toward that, and I know it's your bill to write, but, you know, I would like us to have some input into it, if you wouldn't mind.
I would love it.
Okay. Well, I'll just wait for your call.
And so make sure she gets that, we get that appointment taken care of. But it's been a pleasure. It's the first year that we've had a Greater Minnesota committee. And I hope we've dispelled, and I am going to send that list to Mahoney, about how many bills affected both Greater Minnesota and the Metro, because it's significant. In fact, we raised the cost of one of them $10 million just because we wanted to make sure the Metro was included. I want to thank everybody for being on this committee. I hope it's been a good experience, and I look forward to next year. With that, we're adjourned.